Now, just before this podcast starts, I'd like to make a small correction. In this podcast, we refer to cold and flu clinics, or CBAC. The correct term here in New Zealand is COVID-19 test stations, and they've been established around the country for testing cases that meet specific criteria. If you have them locally, follow the local policy for who is suitable to refer, and do not use them for cases outside their remit. Now, on with the podcast. So it is Sunday, March the 22nd, and it's 11:10 in the morning here in New Zealand. And following on from our podcast on Friday, we mentioned that this might be a good platform for us to talk to the community and to discuss things amongst ourselves in relation to the evolving COVID-19 pandemic. So I'm joined today again by Dr. Richard Chen, who we heard from on Friday, who is has a lot of experience around this pandemic through working with the Ministry of Health on quarantine measures from the rescue flights from Wuhan and the cruise liner quarantine. And we're also joined today by Dr. David Gologli, who is the chair of the Executive Committee of the Royal New Zealand College of Urgent Care, and he's also heading up the subcommittee for the pandemic response for the college. So welcome back to both of you. What we'll do is start with Richard. If you could give us maybe an update, as I say, it's just gone 11 on Sunday the 22nd here in New Zealand time, an update of where we're at from a New Zealand perspective and maybe a world perspective with some numbers and details.
Great. Morning, Guy and David. The latest WHO situation report shows us that there are 266,000 confirmed cases globally, with 11,184 deaths. The situation report for yesterday, or correspondingly for New Zealand time today, is yet to be released. The main areas where these confirmed cases and deaths are coming from are still those two large hotspots in China and Italy. When I said to you that there were 400 plus deaths in one day on the podcast we did last, I had to check the numbers when listening to the edit, because it was just an incredible amount. But the numbers actually gone up to nearly 800 in one day, 793 by a lot of the media reports. So that's just incredible. And there are still some cases coming in through China, but most of these, if not all of these, are imports. So to some extent, they have got it a bit better. In New Zealand, yesterday's report from the Director General and Jacinda Ardern confirmed 52 cases in New Zealand, which was a 33% rise on the 39 that was confirmed the day before. And then upon that, the 28 that came before that, which is a 39% increase. So we are going at a pretty high clip, a very rapid rate. I think the main issue that people have now is there are potential cases being discussed which don't have a travel history, and therein leads our discussion for what we're going to do if community spread becomes a big issue.
Okay, so you've mentioned the concern about community spread, and the GP College have released some information, or are in the process of releasing some information to their members about controlling spread within their clinics. And so you guys in the Pandemic Response Committee have been discussing measures that urgent care clinics can be considering or should be considering, or even we should be mandating that they do. So first of all, welcome to the podcast, David. This is the first time you've appeared. A shame it can't be under slightly easier conditions, but you've been leading up the committee, so I'll let you talk about what you guys have been discussing around controlling this from an urgent care point of view.
Yep, thanks, Guy. Hi, Richard. Thanks for asking me on. So we are looking at putting out a message to all clinic owners and to all our members, registrars and fellows, about significant changes that we think should be taken in the way that clinics are run to minimize the risk of transmission of COVID-19. As you probably know, the GPs have written to their members advising that they switch where possible to virtual consultations. In urgent care, this isn't going to be practical for a lot of the cases, but for those cases where it can be done, we'd strongly recommend that clinics do this and think very carefully. Does this person really need to come and see a doctor? Can they be consulted virtually? Can their triage be done virtually? So some of the steps that we've been discussing at the Pandemic Response Committee, some relate to reducing the risk of virus transmission for those patients who do have to attend in person. We're looking at recommending to close or at the very least minimize use of the waiting rooms. The Italian experience is waiting rooms have been a major source of viral spread, and we don't want our medical facilities to become virus transmission centers. So we're recommending that people move to having patients make appointments or wait outside the facility, either at home or in their cars, and call the patient in only when a clinician is ready. We're recommending to space out appointments, and actually moving to appointments is a major thing for urgent care facilities, but we think this should be done. Prepare for longer hours, but aim for fewer patients in the facility at any one time. And obvious things like removing fomites from the clinic, such as magazines, playhouses, toys. A minimal touch policy, thinking about ways to reduce the need for patients to touch items, such as doors, counters, chairs, pens, clipboards, even chairs and plinths. Things like dictating registration form details to a staff member, using contactless payments, an obvious one, discouraging cash. And there are a large number of other recommendations, which I won't sort of go over in detail in all cases now, but we'll be planning to send these out to members later on today. So the two major things, reducing the risk of virus transmission for those patients who do attend and actually preventing patients from attending in the first place. In other words, to minimize the duration and number of face-to-face consultations. So we've spoken about virtualization already for either the whole consultation or just for the triage part. Letting the clinic's patients know. Some clinics may be in a position where they can actually contact the patients who have attended their facility previously en masse and let them know that they'll be doing things differently and that the patients should, unless it requires immediate attention, be calling the facility to organize, to talk to somebody about what the best way to handle their problem is. Be it by a nurse triage initially, by phone or by video, or by a remote consultation. Putting a sign on the door, ideally we'd have these Ministry of Health branded and standardized wording. We don't appear to have that just yet, but a sign that just tells patients the basics to not enter unless it requires immediate attention, but to call reception. Cold and flu clinics, if you can call them that, are starting to pop up. I hear that they're a bit picky about who they see and that they're really only doing testing at the moment. I don't know if that's true, but we think it would be a good idea for there to be standalone facilities to assess and test possible COVID-19 cases. And obviously, we'd be advising our members to divert patients with possible COVID-19 to these facilities if possible. There are other things that the college will aim to push for, ensuring supplies of personal protective equipment. That's absolutely essential. Our staff must be protected from patients who have this virus, and likewise, patients who don't have this virus must be protected from picking up the virus at a medical facility. Stocks of medications that are showing promise. There are several medications that in small or in one case, medium-sized clinical trials have shown distinct promise in reducing the coronavirus 19 load and in clinical improvement in patients. And also mobilizing resources, not strictly our business, but doing the best we can to use the resources we have to ensure that there are ventilators, for example, and staff who can use them for the inevitable burden of patients that we seem to be headed to experiencing.
Okay, so David, you're saying that there's going to be a letter sent out to our members, hopefully today, that will clarify the points that you've mentioned there. And I just wanted to move on to Kelvin's petition. Dr. Kelvin Ward, who was with us on the previous podcast, has put out another petition to the government. And we'll have a chat with Kelvin in due course about that as a specific thing. But people can will probably have seen his email going around, and they should certainly read his petition and make up their own minds based on that, on an individual point of view. But one of the things that he was talking about was the fact that quarantine is better than self-isolation. We can't rely on people being doing the self-isolation. There's a lot of stories of people being wandering around, having had tests and the like, just from all over the place. And these were replicated in some of the hotspots around the country. So if I go to you now, Richard, with respect to quarantine, because you've had the experience of dealing with quarantine measures for those returning New Zealanders earlier in this pandemic. What's the difference between quarantine and self-isolation, and why would it make a difference? Why would the measures that Kelvin's been suggesting make that difference?
So, Guy, let me first add a little bit to what David was saying before about the GP litter. Their goal was more to get all their consultations into a virtual realm, and their aim on the target was 70% reduction. And for urgent care, that's not going to be particularly practical, given that we see a lot of ACC injuries, acute medical surgical consultations that require x-ray, ultrasound, immediate referral, and that just can't be done with a virtual consultation. So we do have to be realistic about that. And the next point was about cleaning all of the rooms each and every time after a patient. A lot of people have been saying do that for all patients, even those without respiratory symptoms. And some may find that extremely impractical from a time perspective. I would suggest doing it for all respiratory cases, whether COVID-19 or not, if you can't do every particular patient. The issue with the dedicated swab clinics and the ARFS triage and DHB services would still indicate we shouldn't be seeing anybody who's moderately or severely unwell. And if we can bypass these patients directly to their ND position, such as if a moderately to severely unwell respiratory patient were to be triaged on the phone by the respective receptionist, then they should be directed and discussed with the local ED, who can then set up potential negative pressure rooms or appropriate isolation within the hospital facility, so that we can prevent spread amongst our waiting rooms. So with all that being said, I'll answer your question about the quarantine. What's the difference between quarantine and isolation measures that we have in place at the moment? There is quite a big difference, and the main difference is in enforcement. At the moment, if you go on the Ministry of Health and ARFS websites, the distinction between those that are returning from travel with no symptoms, those having had contact with a confirmed case and don't have symptoms, those who have symptoms but no contact with COVID-19 or travel history, the distinction between those is not particularly huge, and it should be. So, for example, what the guidelines from the Ministry of Health say at the moment is more or less a blanket 14-day home isolation. The exact recommendations are that you self-isolate from the date you departed the last country you visited, for those that have travel history, or from the time you had exposure from a confirmed COVID-19 case. And you are allowed to go back to your home, your flat, and be in isolated contact from your flatmates and family members. In New Zealand, we know we're going to have a huge problem with this, because we have large family households, and the way that the housing in New Zealand is made is we're focusing on high density. Just think of all of the Kiwi build apartments and townhouses that we're putting up, as well as all of the poorer, lower social economic areas where there are, let's say, six or seven people in one household, the realities of home isolation is very, very impractical and very, very unrealistic. The Ministry of Health advises that you should not share dishes, drinking glasses, cups, utensils, towels, pillows, and you should be staying away from people, ideally having your own room. There's also some brief advice about if you have pets or children. So you can take this and try to do the best you can, but with home isolation, all you can do is try. With quarantine, this is not up to you. You can factor in to account for all of those things that are out of your control, such as somebody coming into your room unannounced, such as your pet or your child coming through and wanting to see you. Even on a quarantine site where we have much better control of these things, in particular with the children, we really struggled for them to isolate away from potentially affected parents because they would touch their faces, they would then come over and touch you. And we know that even though children are not likely to have severe illness, they can be carriers of the illness and transmit it amongst our community. So it does sound like from everything that's going on, quarantine may be the only game left in town to help us control this issue.
So we've mentioned Kelvin's petition. Kelvin's currently in the process of acquiring quite a number of signatures and will be presenting this petition to Parliament later on today. So there will be a follow-up chat with him regarding this. And as we've said in the previous podcast, it's very important for our members to keep up to date with Ministry of Health guidelines through their website, through their Twitter and other social media platforms, so that you can be fully aware of what's happening, because things will change and there will be an announcement at 12 o'clock today which will maybe introduce some new measures that may change all of these things. So it's important for people to keep an eye on how these things are changing, but certainly quarantine seems a much more rigorous way of preventing the known cases that have in this country from being maintained in one place and not spread through the community. From a point of view of community transmission and quarantine measures, Richard, is there anything further that you would add to what's been said?
I think the way other countries have done it, which has been shown to be effective, is that they will quarantine the positive cases. When we say quarantine, we're talking about patients who have been symptomatic, and that's the main way that you'll get tested in New Zealand, because we're not doing mass asymptomatic testing. You're symptomatic, you've been tested positive with COVID-19. What we're seeing other countries do is put these people into quarantine, such as a facility controlled by medical professionals, where we know that the isolation precautions will be followed to the T as much as possible. And so everybody else can carry on and function. So this is, we're talking about the economy, we're talking about GP clinics, we're talking about the hospitals. So what would that kind of quarantine look like? It would be different for different people. Once you are sick, the time frame for you to be back into the community is going to be different for different people. The CDC did release some guidelines on the 16th of March, same time that I believe last ARF's primary care protocol was released. And that did say that from a time of recovery perspective, one way you could do it is that you need to be at least 7 days out from the start of your symptoms of COVID-19, and you need to be free of fever, free of respiratory symptoms. There is some judgment in that, because we know that coughs can linger up to 2 to 3 weeks even for the common cold, but you need to be significantly improved of your respiratory symptoms. And then you need to be 72 hours after that improvement. The other way the CDC have classified somebody who might be safe to be removed from quarantine is for you to have been free of the fever and the respiratory symptoms and then test negative after initially testing positive on your COVID-19 swab. At this point in New Zealand, I don't think we have that option due to the availability of swabbing and the lab test restrictions. So at the moment, when we say quarantine, we're not saying put everybody into a quarantine facility just yet. Because if we take the people out that are positive, we know that these guys are the ones who are potentially releasing it more amongst our community. This also frees up the homes for proper self-isolation. So this is for all of those people who the Ministry of Health have indicated on the website need to do the 14 days. So the 14 days comes from the incubation period. And so this is anybody with travel history, anybody who's had a close contact with COVID-19. It's not true home isolation if you're in a house with a highly suspected case or a positive case, which may be the case for some people who don't have an option. For example, if you were to consider the case of myself and my spouse, we both work in the medical profession, and if one of us were to become positive, the suggestion might be that the positive person stay within the house by themselves, and then the one who has no symptoms but has now been classified as having direct contact with a COVID-19 case, they would have to go somewhere else. And where would they go unless the government has a lot of places for people to stay who are well but have had COVID-19 contact? You would have to go and stay with a relative. But that defeats the purpose of home isolation, because then if I go and stay with my elderly mother and I get sick, even though I'm asymptomatic now, then she becomes a potential case later on. So we really need to, I think, at least think about quarantining for positives.
Okay, so sometime this afternoon, when this podcast comes out too, our members should check their inboxes for a letter from the college that outlines everything that we that the college has feels is appropriate for this point in time. This is a bit of a movable feast, though, and things will change. So there are going to hopefully be updates that we will try and relay through both the internet and through the podcast. And Richard, you've got lots of experience and opinions on the quarantine side of things, and we can certainly catch up with you again on that. And we will, as I say, catch up with Kelvin, depending on how things go with his petition. He may or may not have a lot to say about that. So we'll try and use this podcast to keep coming back to this topic, just to keep talking about it and raise points. We'd encourage any questions to be sent through to the podcast email and or messaged on Facebook or wherever. And just to re-emphasize from before, always check the Ministry of Health updates and do your utmost to keep yourself safe. And if you're not safe, you're not in a good position to look after your patients. So prioritise yourself in all of this. So in the meantime, David, thank you for joining us and for working over the weekend on creating a response and leading in that regard. And Richard, yourself, you're involved in that. Thank you for speaking with us today. We will be, as I say, back at various points, both on the podcast and through other virtual mediums. So for now, everybody stay safe, and thanks for listening.